Spout Blog and the Webby-nominated Film Couch podcast are covering what's truly interesting in the film world every day. Find out why the New York Times says Spout Blog's got it all at blog.spout.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Matty Robinson. This week, somebody in the studio ain't what he appears to be. Right now, that may be one or two of us. We count down our top five movie creatures.
Plus, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, music by The Clientele, and the third movie in our classic heist marathon, Rafifi.
But first, elves.
Talking fish dudes.
And Ron Perlman.
Oh my.
Let's take a magical journey of mystical wonder, along with Guillermo del Toro in Hellboy 2.
When our world is threatened,
I have returned to wage war and reclaim our land.
My forces beyond our understanding. Our government turns to an elite, top secret organization.
We're moving up.
We had over 70 guests reported. We have no survivors.
Same story here, babe.
Don't call me babe.
Hey, I said, hey.
Red, we have company.
Matty, if Iron Man and the Incredible Hulk didn't already make this the summer of the superhero, with Hancock last week, The Dark Knight next week, and Hellboy 2, The Golden Army this week, it's now undeniable. And I was thinking about how Hellboy might be different from these other franchises or budding franchises, and what I realize is that Hellboy and Hancock are the only two heroes without alter egos. There's no secret identity to protect unless you count the fact that the Bureau for Paranormal Research and Defense tries futilely to keep Hellboy out of the public eye. Hellboy also stands alone, or maybe right next to Iron Man's Tony Stark, as the least conflicted. Sure, he's having some domestic issues here with Liz, played by Selma Blair, and he definitely doesn't enjoy the way the public considers him a freak. But all in all, he's having a good time. He's comfortable with who and what he is. And there certainly isn't any of the moral wrangling you find in Batman Begins, and even more so in The Dark Knight. Because this movie is so relatively light, it's perhaps a little ironic that Hellboy is the vision of Guillermo del Toro, a Hollywood outsider and the critical darling behind Pan's Labyrinth. I think it's safe to say that Batman's Christopher Nolan would be del Toro's only rival for movie geek street cred, certainly in comparison to their summer counterparts Jon Favreau, Louis Leterrier, and Peter Berg. Now, Matty, you liked, with reservations, the efforts of those three men, Iron Man, Incredible Hulk, and Hancock, respectively. And if I recall correctly, you thought Pan's Labyrinth was the best film of 2006. So, did del Toro manage to remove any reservations, or did you, the guy who wanted more darkness from Iron Man, find him having just a little bit too much indulgent fun with Hellboy 2?
No, I don't think he was overindulgent. I will owe that I think he probably used some of his leftover sketches for creatures from Pan's Labyrinth here in this movie.
Yeah.
But I think he realizes the type of film he's directing, and I think he really orchestrates it with quite a light touch, except for one or two out-of-place scenes that sort of smack of indulgence, and one in particular towards the end. But all in all, this is sort of escapist, over-the-rainbow fun, mm-hmm. and movies that I personally seek out all the time. And as such, I have certain rules. And so, Adam, I bring them to you today. I'm going to give you Matty Ballgames, four rules for taking magical journeys of mystic and wonder.
I cannot wait.
Okay. Number one, you got to give me a program with all the players' names. Establish who they are really, really quickly. Let me fill in some details, but don't belabor the point with origin stories. Please, we all have issues with our mothers. I don't need to hear it for the thousandth time. Here in Hellboy, we've got the fish guy. We got the big red devil. We've got the gaseous German thing in this 1950s scuba gear. They seem to solve crimes. Check. I can roll with that. Number two, give me a map. As anyone who listens to this show knows, I need to know where I am at all times. Check. There's a map here. Number three, let me in on the rules of the world without spoon-feeding me. So you've got the fish guy. He likes the elvish girl. You got the big red guy. He likes Selma Blair. And then whoever controls the giant army of these TikTok characters basically rules the world. Again, I can buy all that. Number four, execute all of the above cleanly and crisply without moralizing at me. And I'm willing to go wherever you roll that 12-sided die. And I think here he accomplishes all of those. It's fun. It's lively. It's a good family film in the vein of Spiderwick Chronicles, which I saw earlier this year. The jokes are campy. They're silly. I mean, it's all very pretty to look at, and it's not deep. It's not deep at all. In fact, the only time that this film fails is when it tries to plumb these depths, especially emotional depths. But all in all, I think it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. It certainly does follow all those rules, and I'm willing to even follow those rules when watching a movie like this. I definitely like this movie. It was more fun than Hancock, for sure.
Oh, definitely.
And more fun than The Incredible Hulk, but for me, less than Iron Man, even though they both have great lead performances. I really love Robert Downey Jr., and I love Ron Perlman. He is just so much fun to watch as Hellboy. He's really brash, and he's selfish, and he's brutish, but he's also vulnerable. You totally buy him getting drunk with Abe, the fish guy, and singing Can't Smile Without You, because he's feeling heartbroken. He's just always likable, and you're willing to go along with the fact that although he has these negative traits, he's maybe just misunderstood. And so you do empathize with him. I like him a lot. Very fun to watch. And I also didn't really mind the fact that there is so little meat here. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
It doesn't really try to get too heavy emotionally or getting into any kind of social commentary. It's there a little bit, but really it's pure fantasy. And the only thing we do find in the way that social commentary is basically recycled from the X-Men franchise, where you've got the human beings calling these weirdos freaks, mm-hmm. and there's this war of sorts brewing between the humans and the mutants. It's all very much X-Men.
We also get that sort of slight commentary on gay marriage and, you know, and certainly environmentalism here or there, but he's not hitting you over the head. But Guillermo del Toro sets up this world in the opening scene. He basically, I mean, it's this little Hellboy watching Howdy Doody.
Right.
He's basically saying, guys, forget it. There's nothing deep here. Let's just have some fun. And basically, he starts there and then takes you away.
Yeah, he does. I think for me, though, what keeps me from being too enthusiastic about it is the fact that it did start to become a little bit too Return of the Jedi for my taste, a little too much Men in Black, maybe. You nailed it perfectly by saying maybe there were too many creatures left over from Pan's Labyrinth he wanted to fit in. That is what it feels like. And there are some sequences, like the one in the troll market, which is maybe, I think, the centerpiece of the film in a lot of ways, that don't really serve much purpose other than to show off all those impressive, crazy-looking characters
they've
created.
You're right. It's trying to be the Mos Eisley cantina, I think. And no, it doesn't quite work, because actually, a lot of those characters, for me, I have to admit, sort of ran together.
Yeah, they did. And they all felt like they were derivative of Pan's Labyrinth in some ways, or like I said, maybe Men in Black, where you're just supposed to kind of laugh at the tumor growing out of a character. And I did chuckle, don't get me wrong, but for the most part, that's where it seemed maybe just a little bit too indulgent. I love the imaginary world of Pan's Labyrinth, you know, and the Pale Man, and we do get some of that stuff here. But again, less about serving the story and more about Del Toro just indulging his imagination, which I don't want to confine or restrict it, but there for me, it just got a little bit maybe too campy and too fun even, and away from the story, which I actually like the story, and maybe I can get to in a minute how much I like the villain here in this film.
Yeah.
I actually really like the story. I thought it meandered a little bit too much.
Oh, I'm willing to go along with it. I sort of like this the same way that I liked something like The Princess Bride or certainly Wizard of Oz. I'm not comparing this to Wizard of Oz, but it's that same sort of movie-going experience that I really, really look for. In fact, it's hilarious because the trailer that ran before this movie was for The Mummy 3.
Yeah.
And it's funny because you and I are in the habit now of giving a thumbs up or a thumbs down, sort of gauging. I don't even know. Can we say thumbs up or thumbs down?
I don't know. Maybe not.
Paying $5 to somebody, but sort of gauging our interest in that film.
Right.
And I'm actually kind of excited about Mummy 3 because I like Mummy 1. You have never seen the original Mummy.
And I have no interest in seeing any of them.
See, I love it. I love these types of films. And it's just good old-fashioned storytelling. I mean, and as an example of how much I love this film and how much it sort of excited me, I've been trying to sell a movie to anybody who would listen today. I've been storyboarding a new world because this film, it's so exciting. It just sort of energizes you to go out and start creating these characters in your own life. To me, that's great. That sort of escapist film, when it really creates a world so fully that you want to go home and imagine your own.
Yeah, that's a great point. There is a vitality to the imagination here that is infectious in a lot of ways.
Warner Brothers, if you're listening, The Adventures of Kid Pluck and the arch villain Dr. Mediocrity are now for sale.
Are you trying to make a comment here about me?
Yeah.
Am I Dr. Mediocrity?
That's where it comes from.
That's it, isn't it?
Oh, man, who needs Freud?
Well, I did really like here the villain of this movie. You mentioned last week on the show that this is the summer of bad villains, mm-hmm. right? Because in Hancock, it's basically an afterthought. We weren't as impressed with Jeff Bridges in Iron Man as some were, and we also weren't that impressed with Tim Roth in The Incredible Hulk as many people were. Here, though, you actually get a villain that I think warrants having the counterpart, having the superhero out there trying to get him. And also, of course, we have The Dark Knight coming next week. You said, Heath Ledger, where's your theme music? And we have now seen The Dark Knight, so this is very hard not to comment on it, but we will reserve comment until next week. But I really enjoyed Luke Goss here as Prince Nuada. He's trying to revive the Golden Army and basically destroy humanity. He thinks that they are always going to be at war together. There's been this truce for a long time, but now he's going to take his rightful place on his father's throne and revive this army. And he's a total badass, which you want in any good villain, but he's really just misguided. He's not purely evil. There's a lot of good in him, I think, and his arguments actually for hating humans aren't completely without merit, as we see. So he's a really compelling, fun villain, and I think that Del Toro has obviously successfully shown us before that you can have a villain who's one-dimensional, who is just pure evil, and make him interesting. Captain Vidal in Pan's Labyrinth, I think, fits that bill perfectly. He is so evil that it makes up for the fact that he's one-dimensional. He's so compelling on screen and he scares you so much. But here you have a villain who's not about evil and destruction just for its own sake. I like it a little bit when you are torn somewhat about seeing the bad guy defeated. And I actually credit Goss for the performance, and I credit Del Toro, obviously, for visualizing the character in that way. I also think that Anna Walton, as his sister and Abe's love interest, Princess Nuala,
she's terrific.
I think she is amazing.
She's terrific.
She's really good. They're great together as brother and sister, and that whole relationship is really interesting.
But you know who stole the show for me? I love Ron Perlman. I will always remember him from as Vincent from CBS's Beauty and the Beast that ran in the late 80s.
Yeah, I hope you're not going to say Jeffrey Tambor.
No, actually, okay. Jeffrey, I actually have a
note
here.
Who I love, usually.
Yeah, he's not given that much to do. No. He's sort of the quote-unquote comic relief. And again, if there's something that doesn't work, it's the corny
jokes. He never made me
here.
Laugh.
Yeah,
not once.
It's really bad. He's really trying too hard, I think, with bad material. But who really got it from me was Seth MacFarlane as the voice of Jonathan Krauss. And of course, people know who Seth MacFarlane is, graduate of Rhode Island School of Design, created a television show called The Family Guy. I think it's on Fox. He is terrific here. He is so hilarious. He's doing this Major Strasser routine as this sort of this disembodied gas. I mean, It's just so mind-blowingly Timothy Leary weird, and it really works. And I love his inflection. It reminds me of these old British character actors that used to make their living playing Nazis in the 1960s.
Yeah.
It's absolutely hilarious. And the more time he's on screen trying to lead this team, the more I was into that film. When I wasn't into the film was when Del Toro tried to pause and tried to inject and tried to manufacture just a little bit too much meaning, a little bit too much emotion. Ron Perlman, Hellboy, he is caught between two worlds. So when he goes to that troll market, shouldn't he be in love with the freaks that are there? But he's never really taken that much with the troll market there.
No.
So where is the conflict for him? And that's what he's trying to build throughout here. He's trying to build a conflicted Hellboy, I think probably for another sequel, but it never really rang that true for me.
Yeah, I can see that. And I like what you're saying about that character Seth MacFarlane is voicing. You're right. Very funny. And what is very funny is the fact that, of course, the Nazi aspect there, the German accent
right.
that he has with his voice, then rubs Hellboy the wrong
of
way.
Course.
And he can't warm up to him. So those moments, those little interactions they have are very funny. So it sounds like we both did have a good time with Hellboy 2. It is out now in theaters everywhere. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail at 206-203-2463.
All right, time for a quick break. When we come back, find out which movie caused one Film Spotting listener to say, "Watching this film for the first time in theaters made me excited in the way I am sure people were excited while watching The Godfather in the theaters in 72. I can actually say I was there to witness it." I don't think, Adam, he's talking about Hancock.
Probably not.
Listener feedback is next. Stay with us.
When I'm riding home at night now, I get in so tall. Till the saws and bows that spell out E-M-P-T-Y. We're driving west now, off a spot. My hands are knives. I could be anyone.
Hey Adam, Maddie, this is Joseph Kaufman from Louisville, Kentucky, and I just thought of a really interesting top five idea. Since The Dark Knight's opening up, you know, next week, if you haven't already settled on a top five, I have a cool one for you to consider. Top five actors slash actresses who were taken from us too soon. You know, it's an obvious homage or honor, in honor of Heath Ledger, but there's also a cool twist to it. Rather than just looking at the actors who died too young, look for actors who died as they were peaking or before they had truly hit the height of their career.
Hello, this is Eric from Neenah, Wisconsin. I am just floored that you guys liked WALL-E so much. I saw it at the drive-in over the weekend, and, you know, I need something more than just two characters screaming each other's names throughout the film. WALL-E! Eva! WALL-E! You know, my daughter's name is Eva, so I like that name, but, man, I just don't want to hear it that often in one film. So I'm floored, guys. Thanks. Keep up the good work.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. A couple of great voicemails there, starting with Joseph in Louisville. A good top five suggestion. I really like this topic. I know you do, too. Top five actors, actresses taken from us too soon. My only concern is, are there really enough to choose from for a good variety?
Right. Well, you go to the iconic ones, of course, first. James Dean, Natalie Wood. But I already know who my number one would be. Easy. John Cazale.
Oh, yeah?
Of course.
He was fairly young, you're right, I think in his 30s, right, when he passed away, one of those great actors from the 70s. We've talked about him a lot on the show. His five movies, I think, were all nominated for Best Picture, so a brilliant actor, and maybe we will have a chance to get into that top five on a future show. And then we heard from Eric, who was really one of only two voices who decided to chime in and actually have negative thoughts on WALL-E. He needed more than just two robots saying each other's names. I think we're going to get some good feedback here in a minute that's going to directly respond to Eric's concerns. Let's get into our poll questions, though, for this week. First, before we jump into the mailbag, last week on the show, we were anticipating our review of Hellboy 2 this week, and we wanted to know which of these three acclaimed Mexican directors is your favorite. Alfonso Cuarón, Children of Men, Y Tu Mamá También, of course, Guillermo del Toro from Hellboy and Pan's Labyrinth, or Alejandro González Iñárritu, who directed Amores Perros and Babel. Maddie, how did it come out?
Well, it was a horse race between Cuarón and del Toro, and Mr. Alfonso Cuarón, number one at 50%, Guillermo del Toro, 41%, Alejandro González Iñárritu, I'm so proud. So I worked on that all week.
That was nicely done.
Coming in 9%.
Only 9%. That's exactly how I would have ranked them. Maddie, you wanted to reserve judgment. You wanted to wait a little bit. Have you now decided to weigh in?
I'm in agreement. I think it should be Mr. Cuarón.
Okay, fantastic.
To this point, I think Del Toro is nipping at his heels.
Sure, I agree. I totally respect how this one played out this week. Very close there between those two directors. This week's poll question, which you can vote in over at filmspotting.net, of course, tying in with The Dark Knight, Christopher Nolan's film opening next weekend, the highly anticipated Batman follow-up. And we want to know why you are most excited to see The Dark Knight. Is it because of
Heath Ledger's performance, Christian Bale's performance, Christopher Nolan's direction, or not excited, Batman sucks?
Now, Maddie, I'm going to ask you to pretend that you have not seen the movie.
Okay.
At the time you were walking into the theater of our screening the other night, what would you have said then is the reason you were most excited about
this
the film?
This is really hard because I'm just sort of a Batman devotee. I'll go because it's the Bat. Out of this, I'd have to go with Heath Ledger's performance.
Hmm.
I think they've drawn some fire the way they're marketing this. He's sort of at the forefront, and I don't want to say any more because I'm sure we're going to talk about it, his role in this film versus the marketing campaign. But still, you know, just the way that they roll him out there, he looks terrifying.
Yeah, he definitely does in all of the marketing they're doing for the film. For me, I probably would have said, and this is maybe no surprise to you because I'm such a director's guy, even though I am eagerly anticipating, or I was eagerly anticipating to see what Heath Ledger did with the Joker role, Christopher Nolan, for me, is kind of the lure. He's a director like Del Toro, who I see as a real artist, and I want to see what he's going to do with this kind of material.
So it's Memento. Is it Memento that got your hooks into him?
Yeah, I think Memento was a big enough effort from him that really made me want to see anything he did after that. And then Batman Begins, even though I had some reservations about it, there was still a lot to like about it. So he's one of those directors that, for me, I always want to see what he's going to do. He also did The Prestige, which is a really fascinating film
as well.
That's
a fun film, yeah.
Yeah. So we want to know what you think about The Dark Knight. Why are you most excited to see it? Again, you can vote at filmspotting.net. Now we do want to jump into the mailbag and get into some listener reactions to our review of the new Pixar film from director Andrew Stanton, WALL-E. And I mentioned that Eric in our voicemail there was one of only two voices who actually dared to criticize this movie. I give him credit for being iconoclastic here. We can't actually read Mike Bell's email. He was the other one from Astoria, New York, because he gets a little too plot specific for this feedback segment. We don't want to spoil anything. But he did say about WALL-E, this film is misanthropic, boring, and poorly plotted.
Well, I will take umbrage. Poorly plotted, not at all. This thing is perfectly plotted. I think we made that case very clear. Misanthropic?
I don't get it.
This thing is the opposite of misanthropic.
Yes.
I mean, I guess, yes, a lonely movie, if you take it to the extreme, could be considered misanthropic. But the fact of the matter is, WALL-E is an accidental hero only because he wants to be with someone.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically he just needs to connect with someone that drives him throughout this entire film.
Right. And this is not a slight on Mike at all. I swear it isn't. But misanthropic for me has become one of those critical buzzwords that critics like to drop into reviews that I actually respond to really negatively. I will never use misanthropic on this show. I'll never use it in anything I write. For some reason, I just think it's one of those big, important-sounding words that maybe sometimes people use when they think it means what it doesn't really mean.
Right.
And so for me, I just do take issue with the use of the word misanthropic. I don't think it applies to WALL-E at all in this case. So we will take issue with Michael there. And Eric, I mentioned that we were going to have some listeners take issue with his thoughts on needing more from that love story. Well, Zach Price in Louisville, Kentucky, has your rebuttal.
Hello, Adam and Maddie, or Adam alone, or Maddie's intern, whomever this made it to. You two were both right on the money about WALL-E, but I think the aspect that is not being talked about enough here is the very heart of the movie, and that is the way Mr. Stanton was able to make a really, really beautiful love story between two robots. And as far back as I can remember, movies have treated robots as sort of semi-lifeless killing machines, the Terminator, the straight man, C-3PO, or just some handy little thing to get you out of a tight spot, a la the robot from Lost in Space. Maybe I'm not thinking of some iconic robots as it's very late, but this connection I felt between WALL-E and Eve was the most real thing I have felt from a movie in a long, long time. The electric sparks that served as a kiss between the two robots actually made me gasp out loud with excitement.
I didn't gasp out loud,
no.
But I had a similar charge out of that moment. And so I absolutely agree with Zach in terms of the love story aspect of this film, and I think really that is the best answer to that charge that maybe there wasn't enough going on with this film. There was a heart to this film that seemed to really hook me in anyway.
And I love the reality of the way Eva dealt with WALL-E. I mean, she had to shrug and say, oh no, what are you doing? She
right.
was just sort of like your partner. She loves you for all your faults and of course is going to try and correct you and cajole you, but at the end of the day, she's going to hold your hand.
Right. Andy Harriod here in Oak Park, Illinois, writes in, I was recently able to catch up with Pixar's latest venture, WALL-E, and I couldn't agree with you two more about the brilliance of this film. Now, let it be known that I rarely throw the word masterpiece around without a tinge of sarcasm, but Andrew Stanton's film is indeed, without any doubts in my mind, a masterpiece. Mr. Stanton and his team have crafted a film far more compelling than anything Pixar has made to date. Brad Bird's wonderful Ayn Rand inspired The Incredibles and frankly overrated Ratatouille included. For 2 hours, I was able to give myself over completely and experience again that same sense of awe I felt at 2 years old when I saw Aladdin, the first film I ever watched at the cinema. From the Chaplin-esque universality of the storytelling and humor to the Roger Deakins-supervised visuals, there is more to say about this little picture than I could ever fit into an email. Stanton has raised the bar for animated feature films.
And I think this sort of speaks to the points you made in your introduction when we talked about WALL-E, the sort of Andrew Stanton versus Brad Bird debate.
Mm-hmm.
Brad Bird gets this acclaim as this auteur,
mm-hmm.
if you will, and Stanton, for lack of a better word, is the hack. Of course, we're coming off a class about this very
exactly.
subject. And I actually don't quite buy into that. I think they're both brilliant. But if you look at what Stanton brought to the table in Finding Nemo, and I think that's probably Pixar's, outside of Toy Story, their best to date.
I can absolutely see that argument. I love Finding Nemo as well. And you're right. Even though I'm one of these auteur kind of guys, I think Stanton with WALL-E has maybe taken that leap above Brad Bird, maybe moving ahead of him.
All right. Well, Jonathan Sarpolis from Riverside, California, but my heart's in San Francisco, he's quick to add, writes in, I just wanted to throw in my two cents after seeing WALL-E. First, it must be said that I'm not an animation fan. Soon after being traumatized by Bambi as a small child, I avoided animation pretty much from then on. I had similar experiences with Disney movies with Old Yeller. Mm. I can completely relate. Both my current girlfriend and my brother begged and begged for me to go see WALL-E. After several days, I broke down and gave in, providing, of course, that we go see Gonzo, the life and work of Dr. Hunter S. Thompson, of course, which you and I reviewed last week on the show, in the days to come. I fully expected to enjoy a solid nap, as I often do when dragged to films I wouldn't bother with if it hadn't been for my brother-girlfriend duo. WALL-E, however, single-handedly gave me hope that when I have children, I may actually be able to sit in the theater with my family and not just sneak down the hall for something I figure to be more worth my time. This film, here's that word again, was a masterpiece. I didn't listen to your review of the film until after I saw it, and I must say that I agree with everything that both of you said about it. Brilliant filmmaking.
And I will add here that I mentioned I was looking forward to taking my kids, Holden and Sophie, to the theater.
I was
the
looking forward
weekend.
To taking your
I know,
kids.
And Uncle Maddie wanted to go too. Unfortunately, I couldn't go. I ended up staying home with the little one and let Sarah, who never gets out of the house, my lovely wife, take the kids to go see it. And maybe not surprisingly, Sophie, who's only four, did get a little bit bored at times. Plus, she was freezing, which you know how they have movie theaters, so air-conditioned. She was freezing. She did want to go home at some points. But my six-year-old son, he was enthralled by it. He never did get bored. As some people have said, you know, they've had that experience where some kids get a little rambunctious during some of the slower parts, but Holden absolutely loved it. He came home pretending
was
to
he
be
WALL-E?
WALL-E.
Oh, I love it.
Of
I
course.
Love it.
He was doing all the WALL-E moves and he wasn't talking except to say Eva. So he had it down. He totally bought into it. Let's go ahead and close out this love fest portion of the WALL-E feedback with a couple of quotes from Sean in Cincinnati. While I agree with your reviews because they were positive and my thoughts on the film are positive, I think you guys underplayed it a little bit. WALL-E is, the word of the day, a masterpiece in filmmaking. It is the best film to come out so far this year. It has everything a good Spielberg film used to have, along with having everything a good 60/70s sci-fi flick had. I think you dropped the ball by not proclaiming this as a film that will stand the test of time. I know it's a little early for such proclamations, but watching this film for the first time in theaters made me excited in the way I'm sure people were excited while watching The Godfather in theaters in 1972. I can actually say I was there to witness it. This is Sean in Cincinnati. It sounds a little bit like our former co-host Sam Van Perbele in Milwaukee. Do you buy into what he's selling there?
Well, I echo the same sentiments last year when we reviewed No Country for Old Men. Mm-hmm. Basically, I was in awe of that movie-going experience. I'm not going to take anything away from Sean and his, you know, unique experience. That's great. I'm so glad that he had that. There was just enough disconnect on the ship for me that I can't quite put it in the pantheon yet. But maybe, you know, if we're still doing this show 20 years from now, perhaps WALL-E could be up there.
It could be. I had a similar reaction as you. Of course, I really did like the film. I'm not willing to put it up there with a movie like The Godfather just yet, but Sean talked about the movie standing the test of time. I think it's going to stand the test of time.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not saying, again, that it's as good as The Godfather or some of those other Pantheon films, but I think in 20 years, 50 years, 100 years, people will still be talking about WALL-E.
We talk about timelessness a little bit in our review of it. I mean, when you think of the other animated films that are out right now, Cars, not going to stand the test of time. Incredibles, for as good as it is also very referential. It's also very topical. It's sort of for its day.
Mm-hmm.
This film, like Snow White, is going to be there forever.
I agree completely. And with that, we'll close out the WALL-E Love Fest and move on to our top five loneliness movies. And Maddie, I think we should go ahead and play a clip here as we're going to get into a really good email from Scott in Charleston.
Yeah, I mean, come on, Pink. I can't believe this. You act like you're so oppressed. And you guys are kings of the school. You get away with whatever you want. What are you bitching about?
Well, look, I mean, all I'm saying is that if I ever start referring to these as the best years of my life, remind me to kill myself.
Of course, the scene there from Richard Linklater's Dazed and Confused, and that's going to tie in directly here. Three really good choices for loneliness movies, I think.
It occurred to me that I can't necessarily recall great lonely movies, but that many of my favorite scenes in movies are extraordinarily lonely moments in movies that might otherwise be funny, romantic, what have you. For example, Dazed and Confused is mostly a romp, but we get that sequence on the football field at the end where Randall Pink Floyd and his friends are discussing future plans. Throughout the movie, Randall has seemed to be sort of the perfect ambassador. He has a halfway girlfriend who hangs with the mean girls, the nice girl who likes him, his youthful protege Mitch, and he's friends with the jocks, the stoners, and the kids, and the old people. Everyone loves him. But in this one moment, Linklater pulls the camera back and isolates him against the black night sky, and it's a perfect perfect moment. That is really, really well said. And
yes,
actually
it is.
Made me look back at that movie in a way I never had mm-hmm. before. And man, I got to tell you, got a little dusty in the theater just thinking
reading
about
that?
It. Yeah.
Interesting. Well, he also has two good choices with The End of the Searchers, one I didn't think about, but that great closing shot with John Wayne framed by the threshold of the door. And this one is really good too, Maddie. Why don't you take it? His Kevin Spacey comment from L.A. Confidential.
Yeah, Kevin Spacey in the bar in L.A. Confidential. He comes to terms with what a lowlife he's been as a greedy show-off cop accepting multiple bribes. And then he sees himself in the mirror. I'm every bit in agreement with you guys about the lack of substance of Spacey, but this is a sublime moment.
Yeah, it is a sublime moment. All three really inspired picks there
that
I didn't consider.
That's the moment that Kaiser Soze actually looks at himself in the mirror. Of course, we only get to see him having fun in The Usual Suspects, but here, to see him taking stock, if only for a moment, he's right. That's absolutely priceless.
Yeah, it's a good pick, and this is another good pick, and we'll go ahead and end here. John in Loveland, Colorado, with a choice that I will admit feeling a little bit of shame about that I left it off my list. Somehow I overlooked it. While I thought for the most part your lists were pretty good, I was shocked to hear nary a mention of Paul Thomas Anderson's overlooked and misunderstood masterpiece, there it is again, Punch Drunk Love. I thought for sure you'd include it. Your boy Scott Tobias even wrote it up for his new cult canon column for the Onion AV Club not a week ago. As Scott points out, Adam Sandler plays a character written for him, an Adam Sandler sort of character, Barry, who doesn't live in a usual Adam Sandler fantasy world. So instead of being an overgrown, supposedly lovable man-child, Barry is a profoundly lonely, put-upon and pathetic man living an empty existence, prone to some startling bits of violence. When Barry meets Lena, played by an adorable Emily Watson, he finds another out-of-control lost soul, and it becomes a weird, hypnotic love story. It's rightly identified as a rare, great role for Sandler, and I think it stands up with P.T. Anderson's other films as a great piece of cinema. Had I my druthers, it would replace the relentlessly middlebrow Lost in Translation. See, I told you, Maddie, some people harbored ill feelings for that film, as a great film about loneliness in the minds of cineasts. So, Punch Drunk Love, I have to say, it is a better film for me than Lost in Translation. It's one that should have been on my list or at least gotten stronger consideration.
For shame, Mr. Kempinar.
What about
for
you?
For shame. But at the same time, what I do love about that is, yeah, here's Adam Sandler. Here's the class clown. Here's the guy. Again, we get to see him go home at night and take off his clown makeup to reveal, hey, man, I'm just a dancing monkey.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I'm not performing, I'm a pretty lonely guy. And you're right, he does nail it here.
He definitely does. A great film from P.T. Anderson. And another great batch of listener feedback. I wish we had time to get into some of the top five movies to teach an alien about Earth. Some really good stuff there. We will save it for next week. I'm sure we'll also discuss Hellboy 2 a little bit. If you have any comments or suggestions or any other feedback for us, send us an email. feedback@filmspotting.net.
Time for another quick break. Up next, Massacre Theater. And find out why, from now on, I am demanding, put it in my contract, that Adam refer to me only as the Stefan Waugh. Stay with us.
There's a place that we can go, the end of a long, slow day. Street lamps fuse the light.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. Time now for everybody's favorite part of the show, Massacre Theater, wherein Adam and I absolutely massacre, completely obliterate a beloved screenplay, and you, our beloved listeners, get a chance at winning a beloved DVD of your choice. Now, last week, Adam and I massacred the scene you just heard between Jeff Bridges and Karen Allen from Starman, a tie-in, of course, with our top five movies to teach an alien about Earth. A little on the nose.
Yeah, a little bit on the nose, which some listeners accuse us of. But I enjoyed reading the responses from listeners who shared some of their really warm, nostalgic memories of watching that film as a kid or in their younger days, just as I do the John Carpenter movie. Always love Starman.
And, of course, commenting on your rather, what, robotic performance?
Heard that a lot. I say it was dead on. I don't know what they're talking about.
Never, ever make excuses for your art, Adam. All right, well, why don't you reach into the film spotting hat and pull out this week's winner.
And the winner is Ann Enders from Austin, Texas.
Dazed and Confused Country.
There you go. A nice tie in there. Congratulations to Ann. Email feedback@filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
I think your dialogue is beautiful. I really do. I love it.
Then why the hell don't you just stand still and say it instead of wandering all over the stage? You're supposed to be looking for your soul, not an ashtray.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and I really think the scene is going to say it all. We don't need to tell you what it ties in with on this week's show. Maddie, I started off. You're going to give me the action.
And action.
What will happen?
Oh, I think it's showing itself as a bizarre form of cancer.
What?
And general cellular chaos and revolution. I'm just... going to have to disintegrate it in a novel way, no doubt, and then I'll die, and then it'll all be over.
No, I don't accept that. There must be something we can do, you know, somebody we can go to, tests that can be done.
No, I won't be another tumorous boar talking endlessly about his hair falling out and his lost lymph nodes.
Well, then what do you want me to do? Why did you call me?
And
scene. What I want to know is, how did Woody Allen find his way into yet another Massacre Theater script? If you know what film Maddie and I really did just absolutely massacre, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net. You have until Wednesday, July 16th. Please include your name, the movie's title, and your location.
Make sure to get your location in there or you cannot win. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, please visit us at www.filmspotting.net.
Vous avez l'air d'entrer avec d'elle à mon histoire quand je vous parle du rififi.
I'm taking a drag off my imaginary cigarette. Adam, Rififi, I think literally translated, means something to the effect of brawling. But Rififi, as the cabaret singer in the movie the same name elaborates, is also a way of being. It's a lifestyle. And I think we should all live Rififi every now and then, just to get in touch with our baser, sort of more prurient sides, if only to remind ourselves that we're human. And I like to think that I live Rififi when I have to push the buzzer to get into my favorite dive bar just around the corner, or when I count the stains, like rings on a tree on the bars from Mica countertop through the bottom of my glass, or when I'm spending the day at the OTB hanging with some of Chicago's truly colorful characters, the characters found in the stories of Nelson Algren, and of course, found here in Rififi, director Jules Dassin's legendary 1954 heist film. Adam, unfortunately, you're old. You have a family.
Ouch.
A couple of rugrats. Responsibilities. You have to get your Rififi. You have to live your Rififi vicariously through the movies. And of course, there's been some sterling examples of Rififi through cinema's history. The Godfather Part II, Pulp Fiction, Dog Day Afternoon, the list goes on and on. The formula found in this film has been duplicated time and time again. So I want to know, Mr. Kempinar, when you go back and watch this movie, the movie that started it all, does the Rififi in Rififi still hold up as luridly?
Well, first I want to point out that you're looking very Rififi in your glasses and your button-up shirt and your khakis.
I'm just going to call Maddie, the waitress over here.
Uh-huh. In answer to your question, without a doubt, I love this movie. And the first thing that catches your eye is the luridness, the ugliness of this movie. This is not the Paris of Parisia Tem from last year or even Brad Bird's Ratatouille. It's damp and it's dark and it's ugly.
It's gray.
Yes, it is. And so is our hero, the Stéphanois, which is incredibly fun to say. And you think about the movies we watched so far in this marathon, The Lavender Hill Mob and The Killing. All of these robbers are basically good people. They're sympathetic. They're likable. we sort of understand their reasons for doing what they're doing. The only unlikable character in The Killing, of course, is the wife, the woman, the femme fatale, which is a classic noir trope. Here, the Stéphanois, there is nothing about him that is sympathetic or good or likable. He does get to redeem himself by the end a little bit, of course, but he does very little, I think, to earn our sympathies, especially when it comes to the key scene that sets up his relationship or former relationship with this love interest of his when he went off to jail and she shacked up with another guy or maybe other guys, and he's not all that happy about it. Basically, out of spite and anger and jealousy, he completely denigrates her emotionally and physically. And not that there would ever be any good reason to do what he does to her, but she really doesn't provide, as far as I can tell, any good reason for him to react that way. There's no real justice in that scene at all. And so he's a really unlikable guy in a lot of ways, but I liked that, and I respected the movie for having this edge, especially in the mid-1950s, and I really do. I don't know if you noticed this on IMDb, Maddie. I look forward to seeing how much that edge gets softened when it allegedly is supposed to come out in 2009 as a remake with Al Pacino in the lead role.
Oh, God, no.
Yes.
Please tell me Peter
Do
Berg.
Do with that what you will.
Please tell me Peter Berg is in no way affiliated with that script.
I hope he's not.
Oh, man. Well, I want to apologize to everybody because I'm going to have to cut this marathon short. We're going to stop it right now.
Yeah.
Thank you all for playing along because there's no reason to continue. This is brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
This is the blueprint. This is the word of the day, a masterpiece. And actually, thank God for Joe McCarthy because it was the HUAC committee and the naming of Dassin's name before it that actually got him sent to France in exile.
Mm-hmm.
So here, he gets to marry two styles here, and he does it beautifully. You've got the very sort of American Jimmy Cagney gangster genre, and then he blends it with this continental European, I'm going to say, sophistication or flair, and it's just pitch perfect. Plus, without the Hays Code to worry about, you can exhibit, like you said, the nasty sides of these characters, the heroin addictions, the misogyny. And again, I basically have one go-to criticism that I keep bringing out week after week. But if you trust your audience and you trust your own camera, we will fill in the backstory for each character. And every character here is a pure portrait of a human being rather than some sort of film noir sketch. You've got the joyous Mario. You've got the would-be playboy, you know, the safecracker Caesar, played by
Dassin
himself. And of course, as you said, the Stéphanois, who you have to respect, if not at least like, just because of this code that he adheres to.
Mm-hmm. No, you're absolutely right. This movie is brilliant. And when we did our top five heist movies a while back, we just got lambasted by a lot of listeners for not having Rafifi on there. It's what inspired us to do this marathon, actually. And during that top five, in the feedback, we heard about the famed heist sequence that is the centerpiece of this film. 28 minutes long, no dialogue, meticulously showing how they execute this heist. And I have to say, it lives up to the hype completely.
And you have no idea that it's going on. You have absolutely no idea because he just builds the suspense into scene after scene.
Mm-hmm.
And his use of the camera and the sounds that right there, just the ping, 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 actually form beads of sweat, you know, sort of sympathetic flop sweat as you go along. And he does that throughout. Every scene actually setting up is filled with suspense. I mean, and that's what surprises me, that there are not more movies like this being made, because the fact of the matter is it's enthralling. All you need to show us is the foresight of these characters.
Right.
We are enthralled watching people case a joint, because then later on we can go, oh man, I cannot believe they thought of that and that they got away with
it. You see how things all play in
exactly.
and factor together. And I was really glad, actually, when I was reading Roger Ebert's review earlier today as a little bit of setup, and he talked about in his Great Movies essay two things that I certainly notice while watching the film. And the first one is the fact that the thieves don't talk at all during the sequence, and how that was clearly a directorial choice to build suspense and not something that was done out of any kind of practical need. Because I was watching the heist sequence thinking to myself, okay, I know they want to be quiet and everything, but there's no reason why they can't whisper to each other. There are a lot of moments where they could. So clearly Dassin did decide to have them not talk to each
right.
other versus, again, it needing to be something that came out of directly the story. But I think it's more than just the suspense that he's building that Ebert says. I think that it has to do with these guys being professionals and being good at what they do.
Mm-hmm.
It reminded me of the opening of There Will Be Blood, actually, in some ways, during those digging scenes with Daniel Day-Lewis. it's work. They know exactly what they're doing. And I really think that Dassin is trying to underline that. It becomes almost musical. It mimics the scene earlier in the film with the musicians mm-hmm. warming up, getting ready for the night of playing. It's just like that. And music actually appears over and over, the motif of it. Remember when Mario, when they finally pull off officially, they know they've actually gotten away with it, or they think they have, he lets out a song, right, and wakes his wife up. And the music of the piano, they keep bumping during the heist. So music is really used there. And again, I think that during that sequence, not having dialogue actually plays in, just the action becomes musical in a lot of ways.
I'm telling you, from now on, when you're at a cocktail party and people start talking about Reservoir Dogs, or they start talking about the score or any of these other films, you can finally say, have you seen Rafifi?
Right.
You need to see this film, because it really is a clinic for everything that you just said. I mean, I was sort of in awe watching it. Man, my God, are they going to get away with it? My God, I can't believe he's doing that right here. I mean, something as mundane as testing an alarm system.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the way you are sort of built in right there alongside those guys, waiting to see what little ping is going to set this off. I mean, that is just masterwork.
It is, and I really like that you bring that part of it up, that mundane aspect of figuring out how they're going to pull this off. Because another thing Ebert pointed out that I was totally thinking about during the film is that supposedly the Paris police banned the movie for a time because they thought the heist sequence was too close to an instructional guide. They thought it was going to cause an outbreak of heists like this. Well, they'd be right. I'd be worried too. There are no holes in this heist and how they pull it off. I was thinking about, as I was watching it, how did this movie get on screen? The killing is pretty meticulous, but it does rely on a few impractical things that you think would at least be really hard to pull off. Things have to click together a certain way. The Lavender Hill Mob certainly, I think, falls into that as well. And you think about a movie like Ocean's 13, Ocean's 11, let's say, the good one from that trio. It shows you a lot how they pull this off, but so much of it is just about things, again, falling into place and luck and chance. And, you know, you go along for the ride, but it isn't necessarily all that believable. This is a blueprint. This could be done.
Yeah.
I mean, if we had the patience and the lack of ethics, we could pull this off.
But at the same time, it doesn't go off without a hitch. And then, yeah, you call them professionals. Of course, they're not going to use guns. But when they have to actually improvise, it's with brute force.
I mean,
think about it. They have to improvise really ungracefully here. I mean, you think about the cop that just sort of stumbles in. And that's when I thought, oh, my God, this was going to become a completely different movie at that point. No, the Stefan Waugh comes in, and he's just going to use his fist because he is Rafifi.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is the brawling, sort of barreling way that you need to handle these things. So yes, of course, for all their grace, at the end of the day, they are still just these thugs.
Yeah, and I don't think this is worth its own top five list maybe someday, but have you ever had those moments in movies where you become insanely aware of the lack of technology, that you're watching a 1950s movie? I don't want to give anything away, but watching this movie, you're watching the end of the film, and all you keep thinking is, this all would have worked out fine if they just had cell phones.
Yeah.
You know? But of course they don't. That was in my mind anyway as I got to the end of the film, because it really does become about a string of miscommunication.
And then you go, Romeo and Juliet wouldn't happen either if that damn friar had a cell phone.
See, technology is bad.
It's ruining. This is what I've been saying. This is my crusade, and of course I'm on a podcast.
Exactly, and a radio show. It doesn't make any sense at all. That's fine. Well, maybe we are going to stop there with Rafifi, Maddie, because we're actually going to take a break. There's no reason to go on. We do have the Italian Job with Michael Caine scheduled for next week, but with our top five performances of the year coming up and our top five movies of the year coming up, we're going to take a 2-week hiatus from the Heist Movie Marathon. And all I got to say is, if you're out there at home and you're not playing along with this marathon, now's your chance. You have 2 weeks to get caught up on these three films, which we have both given glowing reviews to.
All right, time for one last quick break. When we come back, Adam and I offer up a rogues gallery of Wookiees and Gremlins with a list of our top five movie creatures. Stay with us.
To make a tempest of our dreams, your white skin on my lips, it seems. But I must throw fingers through this night without an end. To let your eyes uncover mine, the fading heat, the broken lines, the summer in the shadows of your body next to mine. And good night, my darling.
Time now to take a look at what is new on DVD coming out this Tuesday, and it's a light week, Maddie, but maybe fitting, since we did just talk about Rafifi, that The Bank Job is out with Jason Statham and Saffron Burroughs. Actually, a movie I saw, you did not see. We did our little heist movie.
Right, I got to take in
double
Flawless,
feature. You
right,
got to take
Michael
in Flawless.
Caine. But you like The Bank Job.
I like The Bank Job. It's definitely worth seeing now that it's out on DVD. And then two movies that really didn't see theaters at all, as far as I can tell. One, Penelope. This is the movie with Christina Ricci and my man crush, James McAvoy.
Dude, I think they filmed this thing back in 1994.
I know.
This thing was slated to come out like summers ago.
Right, and we were going to review it at some point, and then it just kept getting pushed back and pushed back. Now you can see it on DVD. As much as I love McAvoy, I can't say I'm going to rush out to see Penelope, but it is out there now. Never Forever is a movie you probably have not heard of, Maddie, and I can tell from the quizzical look on your face. That's not a slight. Very few people have heard of this movie. It played at Sundance back in 2007, and I've been wondering if it was going to come out. And it's got Vera Farmiga in it from The Departed, and it's actually a movie worth seeing now that it's out on DVD. I say check it out. She plays a woman that seems to have this idyllic life, upper class. She has a Korean husband, and it's very important to him to have a son, and he's going through some depression, and they can't get pregnant. So she decides she's going to help her husband out by getting pregnant. And she hopes that's going to solve their problems, and she's going to pretend that it's really his baby. And she ends up striking up this relationship with this other man. And I will just say, and it's not titillating in any way, but there is a love scene in it. Sam and I talked about it back at that Sundance Film Festival when we reviewed it, that it's got a love scene in it, which I think is one of the hottest, sexiest, sultriest scenes that I can remember in a recent film. So, again, and it's not titillating in any way, but it's just a really good, effective, hot scene.
Well, you had me at Vera Farmiga anyway, so.
Right. Well, Never Forever. Hopefully I got a few people to add that to their queues now with that little explanation. But those three movies coming out this Tuesday on DVD.
All right, it's time now to thank everybody who surfed their way over to filmspotting.net this past week and threw some of their hard-earned dollars our way in support of the show. As always, we are truly, truly humbled by each and every donation, and it goes such a long way in keeping us doing what we're doing. And my God, thank you.
Unbelievable.
Thank you to Robert from, I'm going to absolutely massacre this, and he doesn't deserve this at all. Robert from Dalgety Bay, Dunfermline, Fife, Scotland.
Dunfermline?
Let's go with that.
Fife, Scotland.
For his donation, I mean, he is basically a patron saint of Film Spotting.
Platinum
Club donor. Thank you so much.
Wow.
And also to Lauren from Highgate, London, a Gold Club donor. Thank you so much. Matt from the great city of Lakes, Minneapolis, Minnesota, and Stephen from San Jose, California. Both of those guys also Silver Club donors. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And thank you to Danielle from Melbourne, Victoria, Australia. I'm telling you,
we're going there. We need to go there.
I cannot wait. Can we go down? Can we go down to like the Sydney Film Fest?
Forget Sundance. Let's go to Australia.
I've always wanted to go.
Me
Aussie,
too.
Aussie, Aussie. Jane from Dunwoody, Georgia, also donated. Thank you so much. And to Joshua from right up the way here in beautiful Wilmette, Illinois. Thank you guys all.
We'll also go to the Dunwoody Film Festival in Georgia, Jane. We don't want to slight you at all. It sounds great down there. We also have a quick correction from last week's show. Very generous donor and longtime listener, Abdullah from Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. Little mix up with his name and the city he's from, but Abdullah has been a longtime listener. He even has a Sam Van Halgren nickname, and so we did want to quickly correct that and thank him for his generosity.
Well, the situation has been dealt with. Another intern, unfortunately,
bites the dust.
Now, do remember that for every $10 you donate to the show, your name is entered into the Film Spotting hat, and at the end of the month, we pick a name, and you get to pick a film for us to review on an upcoming edition of Film Spotting After Hours, a little rafifi, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
If you'd like to donate, go to filmspotting.net and click on the donation tab. It's right there at the top of the page.
And I'm thinking, Maddie, that maybe with all this generosity we've had lately from our listeners, that we need to throw in addition to the listener's choice, maybe we need to have a runner-up prize, some Film Spotting swag, a t-shirt or something.
Easy. We don't already do that?
No, we don't.
Oh, heads are going to roll.
Yeah. Well, our next After Hours is coming soon. We are going to review Scoop, which was the listener's choice pick from our last winner, Peter in Seattle. And like I said, coming up, if not next week, the week after that, we are absolutely going to get to another edition of After Hours. And that does remind me, I want to quickly plug and thank David Chen and everyone on the Slash Film podcast. They had me on last week to talk about Hancock. Spent about 30 minutes discussing Hancock. So if you didn't get enough of us tearing into it, or at least me kind of tearing into it last week on our show, you can go to slashfilm.com and check out their show. They have a little segment called After Dark on the Slash Film Show, Maddie, which we had talked about as a name for our show. I'm glad we decided to go with After Hours. I wasn't aware of the competition out there.
What, they took our concept?
No, I think they beat us to it.
I'm going to lower you up.
I think they beat us to it, but I do want to thank them again. I had a great time coming on the show.
I also want to mention just a quick plug for the Traverse City, Michigan Film Festival, which is coming up at the end of the month in beautiful Traverse City, Michigan.
Yes, nicely done there. Take the red pill. We want you to recast The Matrix. That's our contest for this week. For those who gripe about Keanu Reeves, and Maddie says nobody does.
Who the hell gripes about Keanu Reeves?
It's time to put your money where your mouth is.
Everybody says the man can't act, and I think unjustifiably so. And here he shines in the movie role that's perfect for him, and we're going to take it away from him.
Well, we want to see if you can try, if you can dare to pick a better Neo, and if anyone can fill Hugo Weaving's shoes. Recast The Matrix at filmgaming.spout.com. We've got about 30 entries so far, Maddie. Some great stuff, a great start, but we really want to see some more, so please do head to filmgaming.spout.com.
It's a lot of fun. Spout is a great website, and they're a great friend of the show, and so we really want to encourage you to go over there, filmgaming.spout.com.
Yes, first prize, the grand prize winner, as chosen by Spout, is going to get some swanky American Apparel Spout swag, and the second prize winner, we're going to give out the special edition Blu-ray disc of Batman the movie. This is the 1966 one with Adam West. Maddie, I know you love it. It's got all sorts of extra features, a tribute to the Caped Crusader, a look at Gotham's evil villains, and Gotham City's Most Wanted should prime you right up for The Dark Knight.
Ooh, Cesar Romero as the Joker. Get your fix now just to prime you up a little bit.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. Alongside Maddie Robinson, I'm Adam Kempinar. It's top five time here on the show, inspired by Hellboy 2. We are doing our top five movie creatures. We'll get into maybe a little bit more information about what that exactly means in a second, but I actually want to credit the listener, Maddie, Jeremy Smith from Brooklyn, Ontario, Canada, who suggested this list. He wrote in, I don't know if you've already landed on a top five for the week of Hellboy 2, but you may have already heard about the insane troll market sequence in the film. Comparisons to the Star Wars cantina are appropriate. You touched on it, Maddie, if maybe a little overstated, but there's no question that the sequence is an absolute orgy of an imaginative creatures. For a child of the 80s that grew up loving practical movie monsters, there's nothing else like it. With that in mind, and with particular reverence to the late Stan Winston, I wondered if you might consider counting down your top five movie monsters, creatures, and freaks. Whether it's your preference to run with practical makeup, puppetry, or gasp CGI, there's no question that there's an enormous pool of deliciously geek fanboy options, and the more you start to think about it, the deeper the well goes. So there you have the setup to this list.
Well, as fanboy number one over here,
oh, yeah.
I took this as a challenge.
I'm sure.
Deep to the heart.
Well, did we have some rules to this list, Maddie? Maybe you want to lay those out?
This is not NOM. There are rules. We said they're kind of arbitrary. We said no robots, because that can kind of be a list
it's
in and
list.
Of itself. No depictions of real things.
Yes.
So, for example, no Jaws, because
right.
it's a shark, and no elephants from Jumanji. And I also left off no velociraptors from Jurassic Park, because, I mean, they are kind of a real thing, right?
Absolutely.
They existed.
Sure.
Not according to Carl Everett, but everybody else in the known universe.
That's a pretty obscure baseball reference
right, exactly.
you just made, Batty.
But I really, I have to say, I agonized over this list.
Did you?
I really did, because I love these creatures. I absolutely adore these creatures, and so I had to make some really tough Sophie's choices here to keep some of them out.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because that means you had fun with it, and I had fun with it too, and I do like my list, but I kind of think that this list is fundamentally one not geared towards us. This is a list that's really perfect for a lot of those fanboys of the cult horror genre, where you can come up with some of those really interesting, gory, goofy monsters, some of the campy monsters maybe, and that's just not in our wheelhouse.
Well, maybe not for you, Art House Adam, but for mainstream Maddie, it is a softball fat pitch right down the middle of the plate.
Let's hear it then,
so
number
let's
five.
Hear it. Let's hear it from my friend Jack Black for number five.
There's a little place I know where a bunch of funky people land. They were looking for a sacrifice, one that they had to give to King Kong. Where did he go wrong, King Kong? That's why I wrote this song, King Kong. They took him to a world where it don't belong.
That was JB taking you to a land where a bunch of funky people live. King Kong. I loathed most of this movie. Of course, I'm talking about the 2005 version, but I thought that big ape was one hell of an achievement by Joe Letteri and his team at Weta Digital, or Weta Digital, WETA Digital. They won an Oscar. I loved how expressive Kong was, just the details of his fur. And to this day, I still mimic a petulant King Kong whenever I'm put out. He sort of huffs and he sort of looks away. And I'm telling you, it drives the ladies wild.
And what's the movie we just saw recently, Maddie, where a character gets worked up about something and acts just like King Kong from
that movie?
He was a creature or something?
I can't think of it. Oh.
I'm going to have to think of it by the end of this segment or it's going to drive me nuts. But it was something we just recently saw here on the show. That's a great choice. And actually, you know, all three King Kong movies, I think, have their merits. Certainly the original 1933 is a classic. 1976's version is kind of a camp classic. But the evolution of that monster is really interesting to watch and really good in all three, I think. So great choice there. For me, I'm calling my list the Yoda Memorial List or the Star Wars Memorial List because you could go with Chewbacca and Jabba the Hutt. Some of those creatures are amazing.
Yeah, Chewbacca, you know, narrowly missed my list. But Yoda, I have to admit, if I'm being honest, if I'm being true to myself, whenever Yoda came on screen in Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, I was sleeping.
You were
I
like,
was so bored.
Where's the battle
I wanted Han Solo. Exactly.
Okay. Yeah, I can see that. I was a huge Han guy as well. Well, for me, my number five is The Thing, John Carpenter's movie from 1982, the titular Thing.
But in what carnation, though? Because I
exactly.
thought of The Thing.
That's what's so good about it,
yeah.
though. That's what really makes The Thing so interesting as a creature, I think, is that it is a shapeshifter. That's what makes it so scary.
When he's in the chest with the teeth?
Yeah, well, that's one of them. When it turns into the dog-like creature, and when you finally do get a full glimpse of it, you see that it's actually become this kind of amalgam of everything it's consumed, which is really disgusting. I mean, some guy's head is there in his body. It's really disgusting, and there is a lot of gore to this film, and I'm not usually a big gore guy, but here I do think it works because that's a big reason why you get so terrified watching it and get so terrified for these people. It's not going to be a painless death here. If they get caught by this thing, it's going to get ugly, and it's going to be brutal, and it really did scare me when I saw it for the first time, so had to be here.
That's a great pick, and it's a great segue to my number four, the T-1000,
yeah.
Of course, the great Robert Patrick as the cop that he assumes for the better part of the film, designed by Stan Winston Studios. The first time in a movie theater when I actually thought, there is no way, the good guys can possibly win this film. I really did. I honestly thought, how can they compete with that? He can ooze anywhere. He can become anything just like the thing.
Yeah, it's a great pick. And in fact, the only reason it was left off my list probably is because I saw him a little bit as a robot. It's
okay.
a T-1000. Right. I know it's a liquid metal thing and he's more than just your average robot, but I thought maybe a little too close to a robot, but absolutely a great choice. My number four, not a surprise for longtime listeners of this show, my most arty pick, my really only arty pick here, but I am going with a pick inspired directly from, or actually I should say not inspired, but lifted wholesale from Jeremy Smith's list, the guy who did send in this top five suggestion, and it is Nosferatu from Werner Herzog's version of Nosferatu the Vampire with Klaus Kinski, who I'm convinced that Klaus Kinski himself, forget the makeup, is enough of a creature that he could scare the hell out of you just playing himself. But here, I'll read Jeremy's words. Kinski disappears in makeup and becomes something otherworldly. To my eye, this is the best looking vampire ever put to film. Tough to tell where Kinski ends and the monster begins. I can't say it any better than that.
Kinski never ends. All right, my number three. My first top five on this program actually was top villains. You guys had me on for a guest appearance. I think it was number 64 or something like that. And this character was on the list. He is this Sidney Greenstreet gangster. Easily the best thing in Return of the Jedi outside of Carrie Fisher's bikini. Completely and, of course, utterly destroyed in the quote-unquote prequels that were rumored to have come out earlier this century. But little-known fact, Adam, thanks to the internet, not only did I discover that Jabba the Hutt was designed by Phil Tippett at Industrial Light and Magic, but that Jabba is not a male.
Really?
No. Apparently, he is hermaphroditic.
I did not know that.
Did not know
that. And yet attracted to Carrie Fisher.
Exactly. Doesn't quite make a whole lot of sense.
Maybe not.
Thank you, series of tubes.
Jabba swings both ways, basically, is what
so.
You're saying. Okay. Well, for my number three, it's another one taken from Jeremy's list. And whereas with Nosferatu, I can honestly say I wouldn't have thought of it had I not read Jeremy's top five list. This one was one of the first creatures that popped into my head. No brainer for making this list. Maybe even could have been my number one, but it is Medusa from Clash of the Titans.
Oh, good one. Very good one.
Loved Clash of the Titans as a kid. I don't think that movie's ever made a top five here on the show, and it should. And
probably won't again.
Maybe not. But again, Jeremy says it very well. For a child of the 80s, this Harryhausen movie monster, seen only briefly in the movie, is an absolute movie icon. Special mention to the Kraken, who I considered first. Yes, the Kraken is great too, but Medusa just terrified me as a kid. The snakes in her hair, the eyes, and the fact that you can't look at her. There is something just inherently terrifying about that, because it's such a natural instinct, obviously, to look at something, especially when you're fighting it. It's the kind of thing you could do by accident, even if you knew what the consequences were. You just accidentally sneak a peek. You want to see it so badly. That always really scared me as a kid, too. I love Medusa.
Well, according to Bill Murray, my number two isn't a villain at all. We've been going about this all wrong. This Mr. Stay Puft's okay.
He's a sailor.
He's in New York. We get this guy laid. We won't have any trouble. One of the greatest iconic moments in film history is the reveal of the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man walking down Fifth Avenue. I will put it up there with anything in film history, sculpted by Billy Bryan, and actually he actually built the suit and they filmed him in it. I learned that again today
from
this
the series of tubes.
Really helping me out.
I love when you get out of that Luddite shell of yours, Maddie, and learn some things. But you totally stole my thunder. It's my number two.
Great pick.
The Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, but you didn't steal my thunder enough to not hear a scene from it. Let's go ahead and hear that great scene from Ghostbusters.
No! It can't be.
What is it?
It can't be.
What did you do, Ray?
Oh, shit.
It's the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man.
Well, there's something you don't see every day.
I tried to think of the most harmless thing. Something I loved from my childhood. Something that could never, ever possibly destroy us. Mr. Stay Puft.
Nice thinking, Ray.
It's the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. That says it all. Ray's line there, Dan Aykroyd. A great choice. I have nothing else to add. It had to make this list. So for me, it is my number two as well. And it sounds like we're sharing a number one
this week.
We did talk about this pick. It's the only one we did address ahead of time. And I think we should just go ahead and hear maybe another scene. One of the all-time great sci-fi horror scenes ever.
The alien, of course, designed by H.R. Giger. I remember my roommate in college had a Giger print that hung in our dorm room right above our light switch. The thing was absolutely terrifying, and it scared the bejesus out of me every time I tried to turn off the light.
Yeah.
So there was an absolutely terrible, terrible burglary right at the end of first semester of my sophomore year. Unfortunately, the only thing stolen was the Geiger print.
Big fans at Kenyon.
That alien, though, that achievement, I mean, that bitch is scary.
Yeah, definitely. It's the obvious choice here for me because Alien is one of those classic films, a seminal sci-fi movie, as I said. That scene is so amazingly creepy and shocks the hell out of you when you see it come out of John Hurt's stomach like that. And then we get to see the alien later grown up a little bit as they're chasing it through the ship. And, of course, a landmark alien in a lot of ways, a creature that set the tone for a lot of other movies that followed. They all, in many ways, took their image from that Geiger vision of this alien here in this film. I think of one that actually made my honorable mentions, for example, Predator.
Ooh,
owes
yeah.
quite a bit, I think, oh, yeah. to Geiger's vision here in the Alien movie. So we have joint number two and number one picks here, but that's because they're so good. We look forward to hearing your picks, of course. Some honorable mentions. Did you have any more, Maddie?
Yeah, I've got Gizmo and the Gremlins, of course, from Gremlins, the Fawn from Pan's Labyrinth,
sure.
and of course, E.T.
Yeah, I had E.T., I had the Fawn, the Pale Man from Pan's Labyrinth. I had Godzilla and King Kong just because they're such classic, iconic movie monsters. I didn't want them on my list, maybe too obvious, but they're there in the honorable mention. And then my really out there choice is
Shelley
William
Winters.
Hurt. No. From which movie?
But, Poseidon Adventure.
Yeah, no, that's a great choice. But actually, the Paddy Chayefsky film, Altered States, William Hurt's film role, he's taking all those hallucinogenic drugs and he's doing all these experiments on himself, and at one point he turns into this primitive man character. It's almost like a werewolf that goes into Central Park or the zoo in New York, one of the zoos in New York, and ends up like eating a deer or something. I mean, it's crazy stuff. That terrified me as a kid as well. So I have Altered States on there, maybe another movie that will never be mentioned again in a top five. And All I can say here in closing, Maddie, is I cannot wait to get blasted by everyone for leaving Gollum off the list. I look forward to those emails.
Why would you tarnish your list with that abomination that is that glorified salamander,
Watch it
Gollum?
Now. Watch it.
All right. Well, those are our top five movie creatures. Please send your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net. I'm telling you, Adam, it's 3 hours about walking.
Send your hate mail to feedback@filmspotting.net, addressed to Maddie, please.
Of course, some poor intern is going to have to read those things.
Yeah, keep dreaming. Opening wide this weekend, of course, Hellboy 2, The Golden Army, Journey to the Center of the Earth 3D with your boy Brendan Fraser in a mindless entertainment movie. I assume you're going to be rushing out to see it, Maddie.
I'm so there, I'm taking your kids.
Yeah, and Meet Dave, which, is this movie actually coming out? Is this like another Eddie Murphy movie?
Is Eddie Murphy as Eddie Murphy, yeah.
I haven't seen any previews for it. I don't know. Maybe they're trying to bury it. In limited release, The Whackness is hitting theaters. This is a movie I saw at Sundance, and anyone who remembers my comments about it knows I was not a big fan. Maybe we'll hear something from Maddie's Movie Minute next week on The Whackness?
Perhaps.
We'll see. On next week's show, in addition, we will review Christopher Nolan's long-awaited The Dark Knight, and we're going to share our top five performances of the year so far with our buddy Steve Procopi, a.k.a. Capone, from Ain't It Cool News.
Thanks, as always, to Candace for her invaluable production assistance and to our great listener volunteers, Frank and Angela. Special thanks to Joe Dassault, Ron Jones, and Tori Malatia at Chicago Public Radio, and to the clientele and Merge Records for this week's music. Learn more at mergerecords.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Maddie Robinson.
I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Oh, yeah. Let it be, 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 let it be. Ooh e, ooh e, ooh e, ha, ha, ha. Tip of the tongue, tip of the tongue, tip of the tongue. Let's rock it like we were built to.
Okay.